I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday afternoon. Our guest this hour wrote a piece, co-authored a piece for the New York Times, a recent opinion piece, Capitalism for the Rest of Us. He writes, spreading around profit sharing and the ownership of capital is not the only answer to solving the challenge of soaring inequality in America, but it's a critical step that will help rather than hurt economic performance. If the middle class is to survive, we must move toward a more inclusive capitalism. And he looks in this article at some history that is worth remembering and learning about, actually, what George Washington did to give tax credits to help certain industries, the offer of land cheaply for settlers in the Northwest Ordinance, Louisiana Purchase, and Lincoln's Homestead Act of 1862. We'll be looking at how historically this is an incredible time in terms of inequality and why that is the case, and other issues as well for our guest. We'll be welcoming phone calls from you. Our guest is a distinguished professor and sociologist at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University, where he teaches courses on corporate governance. He's written a number of books, including most recently co-author of The Citizens, Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century. I can't read my handwriting for the second word in that, but if I... Well, we'll just ask him. Oh, wait, no, I can find it right now. Want to make sure I get the title of the book correct. He is the co-author of The Citizen's Share. There we go. Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do, for this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And the email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Blasey, thank you very much for being with us. Good afternoon.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm delighted to be with you.
Let's start with this. We've done a lot of shows on this, but it's good to put this in some historical perspective. You write in your piece in the Times, despite the rising productivity and the shrinkage of the middle class because of soaring inequality, we're looking at times that are without precedent in our economic history.
Oh, absolutely. What happened is, in the first part of American history, although it was very imperfect and there were very many abuses in extending citizenship to diverse groups, there was at least among many founders of the American Republic this notion that broad-based property ownership was necessary for democracy to exist. And for a lot of time, the extensive availability of land helped create a booming middle class. And now, once the population became focused on the wage system, now we face several decades of flat inflation-adjusted wages. People are no longer tied to the land. And we have mounting concentration of income and wealth.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about the history. You remind us what George Washington did, signing into law tax credits to help revive the cod fishery that were destroyed by the British during the Revolution.
Right. So most Americans don't realize that the cod fishery was the fourth largest export of the colonies at the time of the American Revolution.
Hmm.
So the British wanted to engage in economic warfare. They wanted to be sure to destroy any industry that would provide support to the colonists, and any industry that if America won the Revolution, would prevent them from having money to have an operating government. So they destroyed the ships, they destroyed the warehouses, they arrested sailors, they obliterated the cod industry. So as soon as Washington became president, he called in his Secretary of State, who was Thomas Jefferson, excuse me, and said, look, we have to figure out a way how to rescue the cod industry. The industry at the time paid tariffs on a lot of the supplies. The sailors paid tariffs, they had to buy their hooks and things, and the ship owners did. So as this wound through Jefferson's analysis and investigation and the Senate and the House of Representatives, finally, George Washington signed into a law a really interesting piece of legislation. It said that the federal government would provide essentially tax credits, tax breaks to the cod industry on the condition that the industry continue continued the practice of having broad-based profit sharing with all of the workers on the ships, from the cabin boy up to the captain.
Hmm. And move ahead a bit. There was a time, and tell me when it was, when there was fairly broad-based profit sharing and employee stock ownership in this country.
Absolutely. Once we got into the Industrial Revolution and industrial capitalism, really around 1880, interestingly enough, a lot of religious business people who were at that time Republican, the Republican Party was different then than it is now, and they were very concerned about this vision of a republic of free property owners. So they said, well, how could we come up with a way to have profit sharing and broad-based employee ownership? And Mr. Pillsbury, the founder of the Pillsbury Grain Mill in Minneapolis, William Cooper Proctor, the son of the founders of Procter and Gamble, George Eastman, the founder of Eastman Kodak, they all came to this from the same same road, and decided that they would independently develop broad-based employee ownership and broad-based profit sharing plans at their companies. And this was talked about in the press. Business people met and discussed it. They imitated each other. They exchanged letters. There was a real movement between 1880 and 1900, and then between 1900 and around 1925, another big push to do this.
So why didn't that continue to grow instead of diminish?
Well, I think there's several reasons. First of all, there was no federal income tax or corporation tax at the time. We had a very small federal government, even after the Civil War. And there was no way for the federal government, before the amendment allowing the income tax, to provide any tax incentives to companies to do something like this. Now, there was a very interesting proposal. President Teddy Roosevelt, after he left the presidency and then tried to run again for president, on his Progressive Party ticket, we still had tariffs in that election where he ran against Taft and Woodrow Wilson. He said maybe what we'll do is we'll strip away the tariff protection for any manufacturer that refuses to have profit sharing. Pretty radical, radical proposal from a person who was president and was now a presidential candidate and a Republican. But that never went forward. He lost that election running as an independent. I think another really big reason has to do with the collapse of the economy in 1929. Most Americans focus in the early and mid 20s on the big boom and then the bust of the 29 crash. But they don't realize that from 1920 to 1929, there was a fairly significant consensus among business leaders, and I have to say, somewhat negatively motivated by watching the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and the rise of communist and socialist parties in Europe. There was a consensus across the political spectrum that we needed to have broad-based employee ownership and profit sharing to make American capitalism more responsible and popular.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really quite significant. Mr. Rockefeller of Standard Oil set up something called the Special Conference Committee, where he got together the leading manufacturers of service companies in the country, and they agreed to implement profit sharing and employee ownership in their companies. There were a number of business groups that did this. An earlier version of what we now today call the Conference Board was involved. But then what happened is once the stock market crashed, companies had no profits, and the stock values went down so low that there wasn't an interest in using stock to compensate workers. There were very few profits, and so there was a focus then on really survival, putting the economy back together. And we quickly moved to World War II, and everything changes. It's only after World War II, that this starts to, percolate up again.
Right. What percentage of American workers in 2015 have some kind of profit sharing?
We just did a national survey using the General Social Survey done by the University of Chicago, and it's about a third. About a third of American workers have cash profit sharing. However, the amount of profits they get are on average about $2,000 each. So it's very, very small. There are some workers, like the workers of Southwest Airlines, that get really significant amounts of profit sharing.
So why would Southwest Airlines do that and very few other companies do that?
Well, Southwest has had a commitment to broad-based profit sharing and broad-based employee ownership really since its founding. Mm-hmm. For many years, it paid all of its workers partly in stock options. In fact, Southwest bragged for many years in its Securities and Exchange Commission findings that it compensates its executives and its union and non-union workers in the same kinds of ways. In other words, combination of wages and shares. Southwest does this because they think that having their workers as partners is really important for the kind of culture and product that they want to do. But this all gets back to the question, what happened? Why did the profit sharing that we had another big boom in profit sharing after World War II,
right,
when we really did get taxes, why did that all go away? And that's something that we tried to figure out in our book, The Citizen's Share. How did it disappear?
Mm-hmm. So why did it go away?
Well, what happened is after World War II, wages were so robust and companies were adding benefit plans. Union companies were getting generous contracts and non-union companies were imitating them, that there was a belief that the wage system could share the wealth. And then these new benefits like pension plans and such would share the wealth. But at the time, people didn't realize that was more of a figment of the post-war boom, the protectionist economy that the United States was in at the time, the lack of globalization, and the growth of these big manufacturing and unionized industries. And as we know, in 1980, when we started to see the beginning of globalization and international competition and such, that whole world began, unfortunately, to change. The other reason is that a lot of the tax incentives that were put in after Senate hearings in 1939 never got updated by the U.S. Congress, and a variety of changes were made to U.S. law, specifically relating to 401k plans, that tended to deplete the emphasis on profit sharing. So for a lot of reasons, the focus on profit sharing got lost. Companies focused just on wages. Wages became flat, and we end up in the predicament where we are today.
Mm-hmm. You write early in your article in the New York Times that Hillary Rodham Clinton has talked recently about wanting to give workers the chance to share in the profits that they help produce through a 2-year tax credit that would encourage profit sharing. Can you tell us more about that? What is that tax credit? Who gets the tax credit?
The companies, as proposed by Secretary Clinton, the companies that want to provide to a broad group of their employees cash profit sharing would get a tax credit on amounts up to 10% of their on top of wages for the cash profit share payment.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be able to get that for 2 years, and the idea is that would get companies looking, every company would have to look at profit sharing. It would get them examining this issue, thinking about doing it. Now, there would have to be some protections to be sure it wasn't abused, but really what the Clinton group is trying to do is recreate the discussion that virtually every company used to have in these periods of American history when profit sharing, was popular and common.
Mm-hmm. Well, why wouldn't companies do that now, even without a tax credit, particularly those companies that are making huge profits, just do it out of a sense that this is the right thing to do.
Well, it's not that easy. The fact is that today we spend approximately $1 trillion in tax incentives and tax subsidies to businesses every 4 to 5 years, and most citizens don't realize this, that there is a good deal of business behavior which is, you know, conditioned or encouraged or facilitated, whatever word you want to use, by tax incentives. The other thing is that companies have, let's be honest, gone through a big period of restructuring and cost-cutting, tightening up. Labor and unions have gotten weaker, and companies have gotten used to, in many cases, not paying as much as workers would want, certainly not sharing the wealth as much as the middle class needs. The reason for a tax credit is to get companies thinking about that again. Now, there's another part of this, because it's not just giving away the store. What research shows on profit sharing is that companies institute profit sharing and try it really hard and involve workers in problem solving, that sharing of profits can actually pay for itself. In other words, you make the pie get bigger, and then you share a portion of the increase in the size of the pie. That's what really good, successful American profit sharing has been like.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We want to talk more about this whole idea of expanding profit sharing. The article also looks at this attempt in the early 90s to reform executive pay and how that turned out to be somewhat problematic. Yet another program. We've done many of them because it's a really significant issue, and it's a big issue in this presidential campaign as well, the issue of soaring inequality. We're at a time that's without precedent in our economic history, rising productivity, but a shrinking of the middle class and a real stagnation of earnings for most Americans. So what do you think about Clinton's proposal to give workers the chance to share in the profits by implementing a two-year tax credit that would encourage profit sharing? Is profit sharing one of the answers here? Are there other big elements to this puzzle that other candidates have talked about that would lessen this huge gap that exists between those who make a whole lot in this country and those who don't make that much? Do you worry about this? What's the answer to it? Our guest this hour is Professor Joseph Blasi. He's a distinguished professor of sociology at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. He teaches courses on corporate governance. He's written a number of books, including The Citizen's Share, Reducing Inequality in the 21st Century. We'll be with you in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this hour, profit sharing is among the topics we are looking at as we're looking again at the inequality in income in this country and welcoming your phone calls. Do you have profit sharing where you are, or did you have profit sharing at some time in your work experience? Do you think this is a really good idea and we need to get more companies to do this and providing a tax incentive, as Hillary Clinton has suggested, would be one good way to get more companies to do this? I wanted to hear more about this. It was an intriguing idea that you expressed in the column, Professor, that we need, in addition, you say, to more advocates from business and politics. There is also legislation in New Jersey expanding tax incentives for small business owners, and Iowa has done the same. What are those pieces of legislation?
Well, sure. It ends up that most of the cases of employees and managers owning, you know, most or all of their companies are in small privately held companies that were family businesses founded by family entrepreneurs who found that they wanted to retire and cash out of the business but didn't have a son or daughter or relative to take over. And, you know, that's a really big issue, to try to sell the business that you built over your lifetime if you don't have a son or daughter or heir or relative for a really good price and, you know, go and enjoy what you've done. So Iowa has this legislation, and now it's now before the legislature in New Jersey. And it's very simple. It says that in New Jersey, the case says, the legislation says, that a business owner who wants to sell to his or her workers and managers will be excused from capital gains taxes on the proceeds of the sale. if they sell more than 30% of the company to an employee stock ownership plan, an ESOP, or eligible worker cooperative. And there's legislation like this at the federal level, and now the hope is that there will be legislation like this at the state level. I'd love to see it in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. And when you compare where we are with profit sharing with other countries, we still fare pretty well, although there are other examples of, I think you say Sweden, where profit sharing is much more prevalent.
Yes. With the exception of Sweden, for most of the rest of Europe, we definitely fare very well. But we have to understand, it's worldwide that the middle class has been connected to the wage system to share the wealth, and not really connected to getting a share of capital, namely employee stock ownership, or capital income, namely profit sharing. And so worldwide, this is a reform of capitalism that's needed. We need new property structures to deal with these massive levels of inequality. The wage system won't do it alone.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. And Daryl in Bloomington, our first caller. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, hi. I was just in the kitchen. I have a problem in that nobody explains how the corporations and the big profiteering companies benefit by raising wages across the board. Not the minimum wage. I've always known that the minimum wage will not change our economic situation. But if you raise employees' wages across the board, you create a huge demand. They have a huge purchasing power that they didn't have before, and so they can buy a lot more products and services, and so your volume of business is what keeps you afloat, and you can even reduce the price, unit price of your products and services because you get so much more. Now, nobody ever talks about this. Even my friend, the billionaire Nick Hanover, he talks about the surface part of it, but you got to get in there and show them and demonstrate to them, and that includes all Democrats and everybody running for president, how it benefits them and benefits the country, because the tax revenue will increase, your budget deficits will become surpluses, you can start the infrastructure rebuilding and renewable energy, people will have money to make their homes more efficient. Oh, there's a whole bunch of things. It just solves the core problems everywhere, globally as well.
Professor Blasey.
Well, when Henry Ford, the founder of the Ford Motor Company, increased the wages for his workers, he said he wanted them to be able to buy the cars. So I think the listener makes a really very smart point. It was really obvious to people, for example, in restaurant associations, that during the height of the recent recession, families stopped going to restaurants. They stopped going out to eat. And there is a definite connection between the middle class having enough money to spend and the growth of the economy. And so that's a really great point.
And thank you very much for your call. So what is it that needs to be done first here when you talk about companies being able to, in a way, be able to share in the wealth of the company through profit sharing or being given more higher wages? What is it that boosts the income, the economic well-being of those who are struggling at this point? Do they both have to be done simultaneously?
Well, I think we need a number of things. First of all, let's be clear, the profit sharing and broad-based employee stock ownership are certainly no replacement for the minimum wage or fair collective bargaining or fair payment if it's a non-union company. That's really absolutely necessary, fundamental ground floor. But beyond that, what we need to do are three things. First of all, we need political leaders to use the Teddy Roosevelt bully pulpit to talk about the importance of profit sharing and sharing ownership with employees, and to emphasize that this is employees earning a share by making the company more valuable. The second thing we need to do is we need to change our tax laws. So many of our tax laws favor profit sharing and grants of stock for top executives, but are not friendly to profit sharing and grants of stock for regular middle class employees. And then the third thing we need to do is to encourage business associations, local chambers of Congress, and such to start talking about this again, like they did in the 1880s and the 1920s and in, you know, in 1950 and 1960. Business just lost the share idea in their discussions. This, if we have shares developing in the United States, it will be business people who will be implementing it and imitating each other.
We have an email from Teresa. I used to have a job that had profit sharing. It stopped when my company was bought by a nonprofit. I used to make $30 an hour. My position was eliminated. Now I work for a temp agency making less than $12 per hour. This treatment from a company that spent a lot of time trying to measure and gain employee loyalty.
This is a common story in American history. You can see this from the mid-1850s right up to today, that companies that were really good progressive citizens in terms of using profit sharing and grants of stock to employees, there's a change in management or a change in ownership, and that falls away. One of the things that is very important, and it's unfortunate that things get this complex, is if you have a company that's doing the right thing in terms of sharing the wealth with employees, if employees increase the value of the company, they need to think about, you know, who's going to be the next set of managers, who are going to be the next set of board of directors, what are the succession plans, and will those people still be interested in these ideas?
Mm-hmm. Dimitri is next in Waupaca. Hi, Dimitri.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Great. Yeah, I just wanted to make the point that obviously politics plays a huge role, and the laws of the land need to change to support a change in direction so that the middle class can grow. What frustrates me, though, is where is Bernie Sanders in this discussion? I mean, that is his entire platform is all about the growing inequality, the shrinking of the middle class, the billionaires running this country. And so far on this show, I've heard Hillary's names mentioned so many times, it just makes me sick because it's indicative of what's happening right now with the media, just not giving Bernie fair coverage.
Oh, we were going to give Bernie fair coverage. I've got Bernie's whole policy statement right in front of me as we speak, as a matter of fact. Do you want to respond to Senator Bernie Sanders taking on some of these issues, and has he done so in a more forceful way than Hillary Clinton?
Oh, absolutely. I know Senator Sanders. In fact, I participated in a press conference in which he announced legislation to broaden employee stock ownership. And he has spoken about this in a number of his speeches during the campaign and before the campaign. He hasn't given an opinion on profit sharing, as far as I could tell. But he is certainly on record as favoring a broader-based employee stock ownership. My observation is that Senator Sanders is focusing more on the concentration of wealth problem and hasn't given enough detail to how to deal with it. I'd like to see every presidential candidate, Republican and Democrat, talk about specifically how they want to expand the opportunities for the middle class to grow again. And I must say, you know, 4 out of 5 of the presidential candidates, if you add them all up, are saying nothing about this question.
Which 4 out of 5?
Well, all the Republicans and all of the Democrats except for Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders are saying nothing about this issue.
And yet this really is a huge issue in the country because it's one of the reasons, I think, that people are attracted to, you know, it's hard to believe that the political extreme, that they would go to people who are so completely the opposite on so many issues. But it's one of the reasons Bernie Sanders and probably Donald Trump are gathering so many people who are mad about this very issue.
Yes. I like other citizens, watch the evening news, and I see this big response against the political establishment. A lot of it has to do with the kitchen table worries of the middle class. What we don't have yet, and maybe we'll get this in the presidential debates, is specifics. It's okay to talk about the problem and to talk about the rhetoric, but we need a lot of specifics. And I have one very specific idea when we have time I want to put out that I wish some candidates would pick up.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Most Americans don't realize that the 5,000 stock market companies get unlimited deductions for profit-sharing plans and gain-sharing plans and grants of stock to their top five executives. And essentially, you, the taxpayer, are subsidizing executive pay. Whether you think executive pay is too much or too little or just right or whatever, you're subsidizing them. And I guess what I'm recommending is that we change that law. It's called Internal Revenue Code 162M. We don't have to worry about the details. We change that law and say, you know, companies, the 5,000 companies on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, you can get those unlimited deductions for executive pay as long as you have a broad-based profit-sharing plan or employee ownership grant plan for all your workers. If you don't, you don't deserve the tax subsidies from the citizens of the United States. That's costing $5 to $10 billion a year.
Wow.
My co-authors and I, Richard Freeman and Doug Cruz, we have a working paper on this called "Inclusive Capitalism for the American Workforce" that your readers can, your listeners can Google if they want.
Well, there's some question about whether or not those deductions should be something that they're able to receive, right? Why are they getting such deductions? They're already well compensated.
Well, as I said, whatever you think about executive pay, if you think executives are well compensated, why should that compensation and those grants be subsidized by the taxes? That is
right.
That is a big issue. But the truth is that the tax system has really been, you know, captured by business interests for very narrow reasons, and now it has to be restructured a bit so that shares of wealth for the middle class are also a priority.
Dimitri, thanks very much for your call. Jake in Oshkosh. Hi. Jake.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Jake.
Before I forget, you have a link to the website to look at this IRS 162M change that your guest just talked about?
I don't. Do you have one we can go to, Professor Blasi?
Sure. If your readers just Google "inclusive capitalism for the American workforce," they'll see our entire report, chapter and verse, on this issue and our policy recommendation.
Okay.
Sure.
My question is, I was listening to the broadcast, and you had mentioned that there is this employee stock ownership thing being proposed in New Jersey, and you'd like to see it in Wisconsin. My brother-in-law purchased... Here in Wisconsin, purchased this construction company from the founder about 20, 25 years ago using the ES employee stock ownership program. So I'm a little bit confused. Did it expire in Wisconsin, or did something change, or what do I have wrong here?
Sure. No, you don't have anything wrong. The federal government provides tax incentives for companies to sell themselves to employee stock ownership plans, and all we're hoping to do is have the state governments also add their own tax incentives to do the same thing. When your brother-in-law did it, he used the federal tax incentive. The view is that there's state tax incentives, since government is local, people find out better about information in their own states, that this will spread more widely if the states encourage it.
And Jake, is it working out well for him?
Oh, it worked out extremely well.
Mm-hmm. All right.
No, your guess is this is absolutely right on in terms of this program. And I'm kind of amazed that the state of Wisconsin hasn't done it up to this point. It's worked almost. I don't think I've ever heard of a failure of this type of, mm-hmm, of ownership anywhere ever.
Have you, Professor Blasi? Are there dangers?
Absolutely, there are dangers. First of all, you know, any company in any industry can go bankrupt. Having said that, the rate of bankruptcy, we have a lot of good research on this, and the rate of default among ESOP, employee stock ownership companies, is just a fraction of that for, say, leveraged buyouts or private equity portfolio companies. The other risk is very important. It's very important to realize that there's good worker ownership and bad worker ownership. What is bad worker ownership? It's buying your company stock with your savings and your wages in your 401k plan, right? Mm-hmm. Good worker ownership is where you get grants of stock if you help the company make the pie bigger. Yes, getting a grant of stock is also risky, but it's not as risky as sinking your life savings and your wages and your retirement into buying your company stock. So that's a distinction. And then the third thing, there have been some just horrible misuses of the concept, such as the ESOP with the Chicago Tribune, which should have never happened, bad transaction. No one in the ESOP world, except the people that did it, thought it was a good idea. And then the United Airlines ESOP was a failure for a lot of complex reasons that I don't want to take your time with right now unless you're interested.
Yeah. Well, we'll maybe get back to it later. Thank you very much, Jake, for your call. We are welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Joseph Blasi. He wrote a piece in the New York Times. Co-authored a piece, Capitalism for the Rest of Us, and that's what we're talking about this hour. 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Tom, Manitowish Waters. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had just had, listening, you're still very interested, and I just wanted to call in as a business owner, a privately held manufacturing company. For many years, we've done profit sharing, and we've done it, I think, right, and with granting employees stock and also granting them the ability to buy stock, and we post the value of that stock every 6 months, and at each quarter, they get a reward based upon, you know, factors of on the dashboard of our company, profit, loss, housekeeping, quality, safety. And for many, many years, we found that is just a great tool, and it works great for us. And one of the drawbacks that I see is that we did it by a fact of survival, because we were competing for employees and people of the big, larger corporations. And lo and behold, they don't offer the same type of programs and many things, so we competed with them on a profit-sharing program. And our turnover was almost zero.
Oh, my goodness.
And our performance is in our market was 5 to 8% in the manufacturing, which has thin markets, very high. And our quality of operations and facilities and housekeeping was fabulous. And the more we did it, the more we became a believer in it. But the drawback is there's not a lot of people that talk about it. So I'm glad your show today, you know, is highlighting some of those other paths. And I think there's hope with the new generation. I see not so much looking at the return on investment they put in their pocket, new owners. They're looking at how they develop their companies much the same way I think I did. And it's nice to see that look at quality of life and cooperation and those type of things in their business endeavors that they're starting today.
Thank you, Tom. Oh, I'm so glad you were listening. Plus, you have this loyal workforce, Professor Blasi. Almost no turnover is pretty amazing.
Yes, you know, it was remarkable, Tom, listening to you, because a lot of what you were talking about, when we do research studies of, you know, hundreds of companies or case studies of companies, that's what we find. And it's nice to know that in your practical experience, you're finding that out. I also applaud what you're doing. And I just want to add that, you know, cash profit sharing especially is very, very popular with small and medium-sized businesses. We have research showing that family businesses especially like the cash profit sharing idea. 99% of companies are small businesses. And so it's really good to hear your example, and it shows that this is an idea that has, you know, some potential. But as I said, it's an idea that will be led by business people like you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tom. Jim in Madison, hello.
Oh, hello there. I kind of tuned in midstream, so hopefully I'm not being obvious or repetitive. But in my opinion, and I'm referring to larger the larger economy, about 30 years ago, the financial sector whether it's Wall Street, however you want to define it, became such a dominant role. Companies became really short-term, quarteritis the next month. You know, they can't take losses to do long-term investment. You know, they got enormous pressures on them for the next month and that stock price. And what happens is everything is a crisis all the time. And we see this happen both for stockholders and employees. So I guess that's the biggest thing. And probably the most insidious are hedge fund operators. They don't have any interest whatsoever in the companies. They are there for a short term to pick it apart and to disassemble it. They may have been failing and limping along, but they didn't, you know, the employees, you know, were there 30, 40 years. And then this, you know, this capital hedge fund company comes along and picks them apart. So it's that kind of approach, I guess, what I object to.
Mm-hmm. Professor Blasi?
I'm very sympathetic to what you say. I'd love to see a hedge fund go and buy 10% of a company and have them publicly say, they want that company to do profit sharing or employee stock ownership as part of their restructuring. I'd love to see that kind of a hedge fund intervention in corporate governance. But in terms of the short-termism, this is a serious problem that can't be discussed briefly. But let me just make one point, which is that, you know, I wonder whether the publicly traded company in the United States. There's a professor at the University of Michigan, Professor Jerry Davis at the business school there, who has made this point, whether the publicly traded company in the United States really has a bright future, because the short-termism has skewed the way it operates, the way it treats its employees. And I will just give some evidence of that. We have some cases where we have companies that do broad-based employee ownership and profit sharing, and their shareholders, because their shareholders are short-termist, they complain, and that's a real problem.
That is a real problem.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. John sends this email. For many CEOs, their pay is based on stock price. They cut costs, downsize workforce, take the profits, and move on. We all know if a workforce can't buy consumer goods, the economy fails.
Well, this again returns to the Henry Ford idea. I think it should be a major discussion point in the presidential campaign. The failure of the middle class, the decline of the middle class, the lack of income and wealth in the middle class, this will have an effect on economic growth. And there's a growing consensus among economists that this is the case. It's not just an opinion. And but again, we don't hear this being discussed. You know, I hope we will see real issues about the middle class and real policy changes discussed as we see these debates starting in the next few weeks.
Lee, Wisconsin, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I work for an employee owner company in Wisconsin, and we became an employee owned company in 1986 when our founding board of directors, our founding fathers, they wanted to find, there was no heirs to pass on the company, and they wanted to be bought out, and they went to this form of structure. And it's worked out really well. Just this past year, we had many of our employees, we had one that retired at 43 years, two at 37, and one at 10. And it's, you know, wages is always an issue, and not only are our full-time employees owners, but we also have our seasonal employees are also owners. And it's just like you said, we're trying to create our own workforce and a well-educated, being able not to have to train them
mm-hmm.
constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great thing for people. Our biggest problem for our company is that the repurchase obligation that we have
right.
to our employees.
I'm sorry, what does that mean, Lee?
It means that when these people retire,
right.
It's as the rest of the owners, we're obligated to buy them out.
I see.
And we always have to make sure that fund is well-funded. And, you know, it's a huge liability for the company. And that, you know, there we have a maximum of 25% of our wages mm-hmm. are donated each year to this fund provided by the company. We as employees don't contribute to this. And that fund is then makes it enable us to buy out the retirees mm-hmm. or people who are to leave early.
Your comments on that, Professor Blasi?
Yeah, my comments on that. It's a very, very good story. We may not get only good stories, but these stories are consistent with the general research. The repurchase liability problem is that closely held companies, since they're not traded on the stock market, when someone retires, the company has to buy that man or woman stock. There's a really good report on that done by the National Center for Employee Ownership. You can Google it, and that report has some ideas on how to deal with this deal with this issue. One of the big problems that we have, though, is that a lot of the sort of lawyers and accountants and business consultants out there, chambers of commerce, don't have enough information about these wonderful cases of profit sharing and employee ownership that your listeners are talking about. And so there's a real information gap out there, and that's why I think state legislation and state involvement is so important.
Mm-hmm. Well, you need to do a book about it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The next book is on the drawing board.
Okay. Thanks, Lee, for the call. Philip in Oak Creek. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, Philip.
Hi. I'm not the best speaker in the world, so.
Oh, it's fine.
My point was, I'd like to bring into this conversation, I used to work 10 years ago for a machine shop here in Oak Creek. Mm-hmm. And that job had profit sharing. Well, the last 2 years I was there, when we went into contract negotiations, it was finally brought to the company and their attorneys, where is this money? What is it in? How can our retirees get the money out? Because it was a younger workforce, we didn't get paid a lot. There's probably 150 employees there, maybe 200. Well, when I quit, well, anyway, during negotiations, they didn't have an answer. They had some complicated formula. It's this, it's that. You need these numbers, and you do this, and you plug it into that, and it brings you up to this. Well, when I quit, we settled the contract, and that was it for that, and it kind of went away because I think they got caught. Mm-hmm. What happened is when I quit, I went to HR. I go, okay, I want to cash out my profit sharing and roll it into my 401K. And they're like, well, don't you want to leave this here? I'm like, no. So for 10 years of service, I got $1,400. Mm-hmm. And they were investing it. Come out, I questioned after I quit at the union. They're investing this in equipment and using our $12 million mm-hmm. as their own piggy bank, which is probably legal. But I don't think those guys that are left there are going to get their money back.
Mm-hmm.
So I quit and went to a big corporation where the profit sharing is decent and it's transparent.
Hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much for the call, Philip. Professor Blasi.
This has been one of the biggest objections of trade unions about profit sharing programs, that they're not transparent.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly what's needed is if the union enters into a profit sharing, into a company, into a collective bargaining agreement where there's profit sharing in the company, the formula, the transparency really has to be nailed down, especially in a closely held company where their financial statements are not, you know, are not public. I'm sorry to hear of this example. These examples do unfortunately exist. There's something called a deferred profit sharing trust, which is a profit sharing plan which has a legal trust, almost like a pension plan. And they're more regulated by the Department of Labor. You can Google Deferred Profit Sharing Trust. They fall under ERISA.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're a bit of a safer mm-hmm. kind of profit sharing in that case.
All right. And on that note, we'll tell people to go and look that up. We're out of time. Professor Blasi, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm delighted to be with you and meet all your good listeners.
Thanks. Yeah, they are good listeners. Good people. Smart people. Professor Joseph Blasi, distinguished professor, sociologist at the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. Thanks to K.P. Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this hour. News is next.